Even that brought a surge of reflective pride. It's so nice, he reflected in the blink of an eye, that I still have it when I need it. I know that car, it's... Kelly's voice was calm. Okay, I'll get us out of here. You're right, it's time to leave. He increased speed, maneuvering left to get past the roadrunner. He thought to tell Pam to get down, but that really wasn't necessary. In less than a minute, he'd be gone, and... Damn! It was one of the gentry customers, someone in a black Carmen Ghia convertible, who'd just made his transaction, and, eager to have this area behind him, shot left from behind the roadrunner, only to stop suddenly for yet another car doing much the same thing. Kelly stood on his brakes to avoid a collision. Didn't want that to happen right now, did he? But the timing worked out badly, and he stopped almost right next to the roadrunner, whose driver picked that moment to get out. Instead of going forward, he opted to walk around the back of the car, and in the course of turning, his eyes ended up not 3 feet from Pam's cringing face. Kelly was looking that way also, knowing that the man was a potential danger, and he saw the look in the man's eyes. He recognized Pam. "Okay, I see it," his voice announced with an eerie calm, his combat voice. He turned the wheel farther to the left and stepped on the gas, bypassing the little sports car and its invisible driver. Kelly reached the corner a few seconds later, and after the briefest pause to check traffic, executed a hard left turn to evacuate the area.
"He saw me."
Her voice hovered on the edge of a scream. "It's okay, Pam," Kelly replied, watching the road and his mirror. "We are leaving the area. You're with me and you're safe." "Idiot," his instincts swore at the rest of his consciousness. "You'd better hope they don't follow. That car has triple your horsepower and..." "Okay." Bright, low-slung headlights made the same turn Kelly'd executed 20 seconds earlier. He saw them wiggle left and right. The car was accelerating hard and fishtailing on the wet asphalt. Double headlights. It wasn't the Carmen Ghia. "You are now in danger," his instincts told him calmly. "We don't know how much yet, but it's time to wake up." "Roger that." Kelly put both hands on the wheel. The gun could wait. He started evaluating the situation, and not much of it was good. His scout was not made for this sort of thing. It wasn't a sports car, wasn't a muscle car. He had 4 puny cylinders under the hood. The Plymouth Roadrunner had 8, each one of them bigger than what Kelly was now calling on. Even worse, the Roadrunner was made for low-end acceleration and cornering, while the Scout had been designed for plodding across unpaved ground at a hot 15 miles per hour. This was not good. Kelly's eyes divided their time equally between the windshield and the rearview mirror. There wasn't much of a gap, and the Roadrunner was closing it rapidly. Assets, his brain started cataloging. The car isn't completely useless. She's a rugged little bitch. You have big, mean bumpers, and that high ground clearance means you can ram effectively. So what about the coachwork? That Plymouth might be a status symbol for jerks, but this little baby can be, is, a weapon, and you know how to use weapons. The cobwebs fell completely from his mind. "Pam," Kelly said as quietly as he could manage, "you want to get down on the floor, honey?"
"Are they..."
She started to turn, the fear still manifest in her voice, but Kelly's right hand pushed her down towards the floor. "Looks like they're following us, yes. Now you let me handle this, okay?" The last unengaged part of his consciousness was proud of Kelly's calm and confidence. Yes, there was danger, but Kelly knew about danger, knew a hell of a lot more than the people in the Roadrunner. If they wanted a lesson in what danger really was, they'd come to the right fucking place. Kelly's hands tingled on the wheel as he eased left, then braked and turned hard right. He couldn't corner as well as the Roadrunner, but these streets were wide, and being in front gave him the choice of path and timing. Losing them would be hard, but he knew where the police station was. It was just a matter of leading them there. They'd break contact at that point. They might shoot, might find a way to disable the car, but if that happened, he had the .45 and a spare clip, and a box of ammo in the glove compartment. They might be armed, but they sure as hell weren't trained. He'd let them get close. How many? 2? Maybe 3? He ought to have checked, Kelly told himself, remembering that there hadn't been time. Kelly looked in the mirror. A moment later he was rewarded. The headlights of another uninvolved car a block away shone straight through the roadrunner. Three of them. He wondered what they might be armed with. Worst case was a shotgun. The real worst case was a rapid-fire rifle. But street hoods weren't soldiers, and that was unlikely. Probably not, but let's not make any assumptions, his brain replied. His .45 Colt, at close range, was as lethal as a rifle. He quietly blessed his weekly practice as he turned left. If it comes to that, let them get close and go for a quick ambush. Kelly knew all there was to know about ambushes. Suck 'em in and blow 'em away. The roadrunner was 10 yards behind now, and its driver was wondering what to do next. That's the hard part, isn't it? Kelly thought for his pursuer. You can get close as you want, but the other guy is still surrounded by a ton of metal. What are you going to do now? Ram me, maybe? No, the other driver wasn't a total fool. Sitting on the rear bumper was the trailer hitch, and ramming would have driven it right through the roadrunner's radiator. Too bad. The roadrunner made a move to the right. Kelly saw its headlights rock backwards as the driver floored his big V8, but being in front helped. Kelly snapped the wheel to the right to block. He immediately learned that the other driver didn't have the stomach to hurt his car. He heard tires squeal as the roadrunner braked down to avoid a collision. Don't want to scratch that red paint, do we? Good news for a change. Then the roadrunner snapped left, but Kelly covered that move also. It was like sailboats in attacking duel, he realized.
Kelly, what's happening? Pam asked, her voice cracking on every word.
His reply was in the same calm voice he'd used for the past few minutes. What's happening is that they're not very smart.
That's Billy's car. He loves to race.
Billy, eh? Well, Billy likes his car a little too much. If you want to hurt somebody, you ought to be willing to... Just to surprise them, Kelly stomped on his brakes. The scout nosedived, giving Billy a really good look at the chromed trailer hitch. Then Kelly accelerated again, watching the roadrunner's reaction. Yeah, he wants to follow close, but I can intimidate him real easy, and he won't like that. He's probably a proud little fuck. There, that's how I do it. Kelly decided to go for a soft kill. No sense getting things complicated. Still, he knew that he had to play this one very carefully and very smart. His brain started measuring angles and distances. Kelly hit his accelerator too hard taking a corner. It almost made him spin out, but he'd planned for that and only botched the recovery enough to make his driving look sloppy to Billy, who was doubtless impressed with his own abilities. The roadrunner used its cornering and wide tires to close the distance and hold formation on Kelly's starboard quarter. A deliberate collision now could throw the scout completely out of control. The roadrunner held the better hand now, or so its driver thought. Okay. Kelly couldn't turn right now. Billy had blocked that. So he turned hard left, taking a street through a wide strip of vacant lots. Some highway would be built here. The houses had been cleared off, and the basements filled in with dirt, and the night's rain had turned that to mud. Kelly turned to look at the roadrunner. Uh-oh. The right side passenger window was coming down. That meant a gun, sure as hell. Cutting this a little close, Kelly. But that, he realized instantly, could be made to help. He let them see his face, staring at the roadrunner, mouth open now, fear clearly visible. He stood on the brakes and turned hard right. The scout bounded over the half-destroyed curb, obviously a maneuver of panic. Pam screamed with the sudden jolt. The roadrunner had better power, its driver knew, better tires and better brakes, and the driver had excellent reflexes, all of which Kelly had noted and was now counting on. His braking maneuver was covered and nearly matched by the roadrunner, which then mimicked his turn, also bouncing over the crumbling cement of an eradicated neighborhood, following the scout across what had recently been a block of homes, falling right into the trap Kelly had sprung. The roadrunner made it about 70 feet. Kelly had already downshifted. The mud was a good 8 inches deep, and there was the off chance that the scout might get stuck momentarily, but the odds were heavily against that. He felt his car slow, felt the tires sink a few inches into the gooey surface, but then the big, coarsely treaded tires bit and started pulling again. Yeah. Only then did he turn around. The headlights told the story. The roadrunner, already low-slung for cornering paved city streets,
yawed wildly to the left as its tires spun on the gelatinous surface, and when the vehicle slowed, their spinning merely dug wet holes. The headlights sank rapidly as the car's powerful engine merely excavated its own grave. Steam rose instantly when the hot engine block boiled off some standing water. The race was over. Three men got out of the car and just stood there, uncomfortable to have mud on their shiny punk shoes, looking at the way their once clean car sat in the mud like a weary sow hog. Whatever nasty plans they'd had had been done in by a little rain and dirt. Nice to know I haven't lost it yet, Kelly thought. Then they looked up to where he was, 30 yards away. "You dummies!" he called through the light rain. "See you around, assholes!" He started moving again, careful, of course, to keep his eyes on them. That's what had won him the race, Kelly told himself. Caution, brains, experience. Guts, too, but Kelly dismissed that thought after allowing himself just the tiniest peek at it. Just a little one. He nursed the scout back onto a strip of pavement, upshifted, and drove off, listening to the little clods of mud thrown by his tires into the wheel wells. "You can get up now, Pam. We won't be seeing them for a while." Pam did that, looking back to see Billy and his roadrunner. The sight of him so close made her face go pale again. "What did you do?" "I just let them chase me into a place that I selected," Kelly explained. "That's a nice car for running the street, but not so good for dirt." Pam smiled for him, showing bravery she didn't feel at the moment, but completing the story just as Kelly would have told it to a friend. He checked his watch. Another hour or so until shift change at the police station. Billy and his friends would be stuck there for a long time. The smart move was to find a quiet place to wait. Besides, Pam looked like she needed a little calming down. He drove for a little while, then, finding an area with no major street activity, he parked. "How are you feeling?" he asked. "That was scary," she replied, looking down and shaking badly. "Look, we can go right back to the boat and—" "No. Billy raped me. And killed Helen. If I don't stop him, he'll just keep doing it to people I know." The words were as much to persuade herself as him, Kelly knew. He'd seen it before. It was courage, and it went part and parcel with fear. It was the thing that drove people to accomplish missions, and also the thing that selected those missions for them. She'd seen the darkness, and finding the light, she had to extend its glow to others. "Okay, but after we tell Frank about it, we get you the hell out of Dodge City." "I'm okay," Pam said, lying, knowing he saw the lie, and ashamed of it because she didn't grasp his intimate understanding for her feelings of the moment. "You really are," he wanted to tell her, but she hadn't learned about those things yet, and so he asked a question. "How many other girls?" "Doris, Xantha, Paula, Maria, and Roberta. They're all like me, John. And Helen. When they killed her, they made us watch." "Well, with a little luck, you can do something about that, honey." He put his arm around her, and after a time, the shaking stopped. "I'm thirsty," she said. "There's a cooler on the back seat." Pam smiled. "That's right." She turned in the seat to reach for a Coke, and her body suddenly went rigid. She gasped, and Kelly's skin got that all-too-familiar, unwelcome feeling, like an electric charge running along its surface. The danger feeling. "Kelly!" Pam screamed. She was looking towards the car's left rear. Kelly was already reaching for his gun, turning his body as he did so. But it was too late, and part of him already knew it. The outraged thought went through his mind that he'd erred badly, fatally. But he didn't know how, and there was no time to figure it out because before he could reach his gun, there was a flash of light and an impact on his head, followed by darkness. Chapter 7 Recovery. It was a routine police patrol that spotted the scout. Officer Chuck Monroe, 16 months on the force, just old enough to have his own solo radio car, made it a habit to patrol his part of the district after taking to the street. There wasn't much he could do about the dealers. That was the job of the narcotics division. But he could show the flag, a phrase he'd learned in the Marine Corps. 25, newly married, young enough to be dedicated and angry at what was happening in his city and his old neighborhood, the officer noted that the Scout was an unusual vehicle for this area. He decided to check it out, record its tag number, and then came the heart-stopping realization that the car's left side had taken at least 2 shotgun blasts. Officer Monroe stopped his car, flipped on his rotating lights, and made the first preliminary call of possible trouble. Please stand by. He stepped out of the car, switching his police baton into his left hand, leaving his right at the grip of his service revolver. Only then did he approach the car. A well-trained officer, Chuck Monroe moved in slowly and carefully, his eyes scanning everything in sight. Oh, shit. The return to his radio car was rapid. First, Monroe called for backup and then for an ambulance. And then he notified his district desk of the license number of the subject automobile. Then, grabbing his first aid kit, he returned to the Scout. The door was locked, but the window was blown out, and he reached inside to unlock it. What he saw then froze him in his tracks. The head rested on the steering wheel, along with the left hand, while the right rested in his lap. Blood had sprayed all over the inside. The man was still breathing, which surprised the officer. Clearly a shotgun blast, it had obliterated the metal and fiberglass of the Scout's body and hit the victim's head, neck, and upper back. There were several small holes in the exposed skin, and these were oozing blood. The wound looked as horrible as any he had seen on the street or in the Marine Corps, and yet the man was alive. That was sufficiently amazing that Monroe decided to leave his first aid kit closed. There would be an ambulance here in minutes, and he decided that any action he took was as likely to make things worse as better. Monroe held the kit under his right hand like a book, looking at the victim with the frustration of a man of action to whom action was denied. At least the poor bastard was unconscious. Who was he? Monroe looked at the slumped form and decided that he could extricate the wallet. The officer switched the first aid kit to his left hand and reached in for the wallet pocket with his right. Unsurprisingly, it was empty, but his touch had elicited a reaction. The body moved a little, and that wasn't good. He moved his hand to steady it, but then the head moved too, and he knew that the head had better stay still, and so his hand automatically and wrongly touched it. Something rubbed against something else, and a cry of pain echoed across the dark, wet street before the body went slack again. Shit! Monroe looked at the blood on his fingertips and unconsciously rubbed it off on his blue uniform trousers. Just then he heard the banshee wail of a fire department ambulance approaching from the east, and the officer whispered a quiet prayer of thanks that people who knew what they were doing would shortly relieve him of this problem. The ambulance turned the corner a few seconds later. The large, boxy, red-and-white vehicle halted just past the radio car, and its 2 occupants came at once to the officer. What had we got? Strangely, it didn't come out like a question. The senior fireman paramedic hardly needed to ask in any case. In this part of town at this time of night, it wouldn't be a traffic accident. It would be penetrating trauma, in the dry lexicon of his profession. Jesus! The other crewman was already moving back to the ambulance when another police car arrived on the scene. What gives? The watch supervisor asked. Shotgun, close range, and the guy's still alive, Monroe reported. I don't like the neck hits, the first ambulance guy observed tersely. Collar? The other paramedic called from an equipment bay. Yeah, if he moves his head. Damn. The senior firefighter placed his hands on the victim's head to secure it in place. ID? The sergeant asked. No wallet. I haven't had a chance to look around yet. Did you run the tags? Monroe nodded. Called him in. It takes a little while. The sergeant played his flashlight on the inside of the car to help the fireman. A lot of blood, otherwise empty. Some kind of cooler in the back seat. What else? He asked Monroe. The block was empty when I got here. Monroe checked his watch. 11 minutes ago. Both officers stood back to give the paramedics room to work. You ever seen him before?
No, Sarge.
Check the sidewalks. Right. Monroe started quartering the area around the car.
I wonder what this was all about, the sergeant asked nobody in particular.
Looking at the body and all the blood, his next thought was that they might never find out. So many crimes committed in this area were never really solved. That was not something pleasing to the sergeant. He looked at the paramedics.
How is he, Mike?
Damn near bled out, Bert. Definite shotgun, the man answered, affixing the cervical collar. A bunch of pellets in the neck, some near the spine. I don't like this at all.
Where are you taking him? The police sergeant asked.
University's full up, the junior paramedic advised. Bus accident on the Beltway. We have to take him to Hopkins.
That's an extra 10 minutes.
Mike swore. You drive, Phil. Tell them we have a major trauma and we need a neurosurgeon standing by.
You got it.
Both men lifted him onto the gurney. The body reacted to the movement, and the two police officers, three more radio cars had just arrived, helped hold him in place while the firefighters applied restraints.
You're a real sick puppy, my friend, but we'll have you in the hospital real quick now, Phil told the body, which might or might not still be alive enough to hear the words.
Time to roll, Mike. They loaded the body in the back of the ambulance. Mike Eaton, the senior paramedic, was already setting up an IV bottle of blood expanders. Getting the intravenous line was difficult with the man face down, but he managed it just as the ambulance started moving. The 16-minute trip to Johns Hopkins Hospital was occupied with taking vital signs. The blood pressure was perilously low, and doing some preliminary paperwork.
"Who are you?" Eaton asked silently.
"Good physical shape," he noted. 26 or 27.
Odd for a probable drug user.
This guy would have looked pretty tough standing up, but not now. Now he was more like a large, sleeping child, mouth open, drawing oxygen from the clear plastic mask, breathing shallowly and too slowly for Eaton's comfort.
Speed it up, he called to the driver, Phil Marconi.
Roads are pretty wet, Mike, doing my best.
Come on, Phil, you wops are supposed to drive crazy.
But we don't drink like you guys, came the laughing reply. I just called ahead. They got a neck cutter standing by. Quiet night at Hopkins. They're all ready for us.
Good, Eaton responded quietly.
He looked at his shooting victim. It often got lonely and a little spooky in the back of an ambulance, and that made him glad for the otherwise nerve-grating wail of the electronic siren. Blood dripped off the gurney down to the floor of the vehicle. The drops traveled around on the metal floor as though they had a life entirely of their own. It was something you never got used to.
2 minutes, Marconi said over his shoulder.
Eaton moved to the back of the compartment, ready to open the door. Presently he felt the ambulance turn, stop, then back up quickly before stopping again. The rear doors were yanked open before Eaton could reach for them.
Yow, the ER resident observed. Okay, folks, we're taking him into three.
Two burly orderlies pulled the gurney out while Eaton disconnected the IV bottle from the overhead hook and carried it beside the moving cart.
Trouble at university? The resident asked.
Bus accident, Marconi reported, arriving at his side.
Better off here anyway. Jesus, what did he back into?
The doctor bent down to inspect the wound as they moved.
Must be 100 pellets in there.
Wait till you see the neck, Eaton told him.
Shit, the resident breathed.
They wheeled him into the capacious emergency room, selecting a cubicle in the corner. The five men moved the victim from the gurney to a treatment table, and the medical team went to work. Another physician was standing by, along with a pair of nurses. The resident, Cliff Severn, reached around delicately to remove the cervical collar after making sure the head was secured by sandbags. It took only one look.
Possible spine, he announced at once. But first we have to replace blood volume.
He rattled off a series of orders. While the nurses got two more IVs started, Severn took the patient's shoes off and ran a sharp metal instrument across the sole of his left foot. The foot moved.
Okay, there was no immediate nerve damage.
Good news. A few more sticks on the legs also got reactions.
Remarkable.
While that was happening, a nurse took blood for the usual battery of tests. Severn scarcely had to look as his well-trained crew did their separate jobs. What appeared to be a flurry of activity was more like the movement of a football backfield, the end product of months of diligent practice.
"Where the hell's Nero?" Severn asked the ceiling.
"Right here," a voice answered. Severn looked up.
"Oh, Professor Rosen."
The greeting stopped there. Sam Rosen was not in a good mood, as the resident saw at once. It had been a 20-hour day for the professor already. What ought to have been a 6-hour procedure had only begun a marathon effort to save the life of an elderly woman who'd fallen down a flight of stairs, an effort that had ended unsuccessfully less than an hour before. He ought to have saved her, Sam was telling himself, still not sure what had gone wrong. He was grateful rather than angry about this extension to a hellish day. Maybe he could win this one.
"Tell me what we have," the professor ordered curtly.
"Shotgun wound. Several pellets very close to the cord, sir."
"Okay."
Rosen bent down, his hands behind his back.
"What's with the glass?"
"He was in a car," Eaton called from the other side of the cubicle.
"We need to get rid of that. Need to shave the head, too," Rosen said, surveying the damage.
"What's his pressure?"
"BP 50 over 30, a nurse practitioner reported. "Pulse is 140 and thready."
"We're going to be busy," Rosen observed. "This guy is very shocky."
"Hmm."
He paused. "Overall condition of the patient looks good. Good muscle tone. Let's get that blood volume back up." Rosen saw two units being started even as he spoke. The ER nurses were especially good, and he nodded approval at them.
"How's your son doing, Margaret?" he asked the senior one.
"Starting at Carnegie in September," she answered, adjusting the drip rate on the blood bottle.
"Let's get the neck cleaned off next, Margaret. I need to take a look."
"Yes, doctor."
The nurse selected a pair of forceps, grabbed a large cotton ball, which she dipped in distilled water, then wiped across the patient's neck with care, clearing away the blood and exposing the actual wounds. It looked worse than it might really be, she saw at once. While she swabbed the patient off, Rosen looked for and got sterile garb. By the time he got back to the bedside, Margaret Wilson had a sterile kit in place and uncovered. Eaton and Marconi stayed in the corner, watching it all.
"Nice job, Margaret," Rosen said, putting his glasses on.
"What's he going to major in?"
"Engineering."
"That's good."
Rosen held his hand up.
"Tweezers."
Nurse Wilson set a pair in his hand.
"Always room for a bright young engineer."
Rosen picked a small round hole on the patient's shoulder, well away from anything really vital. With a delicacy that his large hands made almost comical to watch, he probed for and retrieved a single lead ball, which he held up to the light.
"Number 7 shot, I believe. Somebody mistook this guy for a pigeon."
"That's good news," he told the paramedics. Now that he knew the shot size and probable penetration, he bent down low over the neck.
"What's the BP now?"
"Checking," another nurse said from the far side of the table.
55 over 40, coming up.
"Thank you," Rosen said, still bent over the patient.
"Who started the first IV?"
"I did," Eaton replied.
"Good work, fireman."
Rosen looked up and winked.
"Sometimes I think you people save more lives than we do. You saved this one, that's for damn sure."
"Thank you, doctor." Eaton didn't know Rosen well, but he made a note that the man's reputation was deserved. It wasn't every day that a fireman paramedic got that sort of praise from a full professor.
"How's he going to... I mean, the neck injury?"
Rosen was down again, examining it.
"Responses, doctor?" he asked the senior resident.
"Positive. Good Babinski. No gross indications of peripheral impairment," Severn replied. This was like an exam, which always made the young resident nervous.
"This may not be as bad as it looks, but we're going to have to clean it up in a hurry before these pellets migrate."
2 hours? He asked Severn. Rosen knew the ER resident was better on trauma than he was.
"Maybe 3.
"I'll get a nap out of it anyway." Rosen checked his watch.
"I'll take him at 06.
"You want to handle this one personally?"
"Why not? I'm here."
"This one is straightforward, just takes a little touch." Rosen figured he was entitled to an easy case, maybe once a month. As a full professor, he drew a lot of the hard ones.
"Fine with me, sir."
"Do we have an ID on the patient?"
"No, sir," Marconi replied. "The police ought to be here in a few."
"Good." Rosen stood and stretched. "You know, Margaret, people like us shouldn't work these kind of hours."
"I need the shift differential," Nurse Wilson replied.
besides which, she was the nursing team leader for this shift. "What's this, I wonder?" she said after a moment. "Hm?" Rosen walked around to her side of the table while the rest of the team did its work. "A tattoo on his arm," she reported. Nurse Wilson was surprised by the reaction it drew from Professor Rosen. The transition from sleep to wakefulness was usually easy for Kelly, but not this time. His first coherent thought was to be surprised, but he didn't know why. Next came pain, but not so much pain as the distant warning that there would be pain, and lots of it. When he realized that he could open his eyes, he did, only to find himself staring at a gray linoleum floor. A few scattered drops of liquid reflected the bright overhead fluorescence. He felt needles in his eyes, and only then did he realize that the real stabs were in his arms. "I'm alive. Why does that surprise me?" He could hear the sound of people moving around, muted conversations, distant chimes. The sound of rushing air was explained by air conditioning vents, one of which had to be nearby, since he could feel the moving chill on the skin of his back. Something told him that he ought to move, that being still made him vulnerable. But even after he managed a command to his limbs to do something, nothing happened. That's when the pain announced its presence. Like the ripple on a pond from the fall of an insect, it started somewhere on his shoulder and expanded. It took a moment to classify. The nearest approximation was a bad sunburn, because everything from the left side of his neck on down to his left elbow felt scorched. He knew he was forgetting something, probably something important. "Where the fuck am I?" Kelly thought he felt the distant vibration of... what? Ship's engines? No, that wasn't right somehow. And after a few more seconds, he realized it was the faraway sound of a city bus pulling away from a stop. Not a ship. A city. Why am I in a city? A shadow crossed his face. He opened his eyes to see the bottom half of a figure dressed all over in light green cotton. The hands held a clipboard of some sort. Kelly couldn't even focus his eyes well enough to tell if the figure was male or female before it went away. And it didn't occur to him to say anything before he drifted back to sleep. The shoulder wound was extensive but superficial, Rosen told the neurosurgical resident, 30 feet away. Bloody enough. 4 units, she noted. Shotgun wounds are like that. There was only one real threat to the spine. Took me a little while to figure how to remove it without endangering anything. 237 pellets, but... She held the X-ray up to the light. Looks like you got them all. This fellow just got a nice collection of freckles, though. Took long enough, Sam said tiredly, knowing that he ought to have let someone else handle it, but he'd volunteered after all. You know this patient, don't you? Sandy O'Toole said, arriving from the recovery room. Yeah. He's coming out, but it'll be a while. She handed over the chart which showed his current vitals. Looking good, doctor. Professor Rosen nodded and explained further to the resident. Great physical shape. The fireman did a nice job holding up his BP. He did almost bleed out, but the wounds looked worse than they really were. Sandy? She turned back. Yes, doctor. This one is a friend of mine. Would you mind terribly if I asked you to take a special interest? You're our best, Sandy. Anything I need to know? She asked, appreciating the compliment. He's a good man, Sandy. Sam said it in a way that carried real meaning. Sarah likes him, too. Then he must be all right. She headed back into recovery, wondering if the professor was playing matchmaker again. What do I tell the police? 4 hours minimum. I want to be there. Rosen looked over at the coffee pot and decided against it. Any more and his stomach might rupture from all the acid. So who is he? I don't know all that much, but I ran into trouble on the bay in my boat and he helped me out. We ended up staying at his place for the weekend. Sam didn't go any further. He didn't really know that much, but he had inferred a lot, and that scared him very much indeed. He'd done his part, While he hadn't saved Kelly's life, luck and the fireman had probably done that, he had performed an exceedingly skillful procedure, though he had also annoyed the resident, Dr. Ann Pretlow, by not allowing her to do much of anything except watch.
"I need a little sleep. I don't have much scheduled for today. Can you do the follow-up on Mrs. Baker?"
"Certainly." "Have someone wake me up in 3 hours," Rosen said on the way to his office, where a nice, comfortable couch awaited.
"Nice tan," Billy observed with a smirk. "I wonder where she got it." There was general amusement. "What do we do with her?"
He thought about that. He'd just discovered a fine way to deal with bodies, much cleaner in its way and far safer than what they'd been doing. But it also involved a lengthy boat trip, and he just didn't have the time to be bothered. He also didn't want to have anyone else use that particular method. It was too good to share with anyone. He knew that one of them would talk. That was one of his problems.
"Find a spot," he said after a moment's consideration. "If she's found, it doesn't matter much."
Then he looked around the room, cataloging the expressions he saw. The lesson had been learned. Nobody else would try this again, not any time soon. He didn't even have to say anything.
"Tonight? Better at night."
"That's fine. No hurry." Everyone else could learn even more from looking at her for the rest of the day, lying there in the middle of the floor. He took only a little pleasure from it, and people had to learn their lessons. And even when it was too late for one of them, others could learn from that one's mistakes, especially when the lessons were clear and hard. Even the drugs wouldn't block this one out.
"What about the guy?" he asked Billy.
Billy smirked again. It was his favorite expression. "Blew him away. Both barrels, 10 feet. We won't be seeing him no more."
"Okay."
He left. There was work to be done and money to collect. This little problem was behind him. It was a pity, he thought on the way to his car, that they couldn't all be solved this easily. The body remained in place. Doris and the others sat in the same room, unable to look away from what had once been a friend, learning their lesson as Henry wished. Kelly vaguely noted that he was being moved. The floor moved under him. He watched the lines between the floor tiles travel like movie credits until they backed him into another room, a small one. This time he tried to raise his head, and indeed it moved a few inches, enough to see the legs of a woman. The green surgical slacks ended above her ankles, and they were definitely a woman's. There was a whirring sound, and his horizon moved downwards. After a moment he realized that he was on a powered bed, hanging between two hoops of stainless steel. His body was attached to the bed somehow, and as the platform rotated, he could feel the pressure of the restraints that held him in place. Not uncomfortable, but there. Presently he saw a woman, his age, perhaps a year or two younger, with brown hair stuffed under a green cap and light eyes that sparkled in a friendly way.
"Hello," she said from behind her mask. "I'm your nurse."
"Where am I?" Kelly asked in a raspy voice.
"Johns Hopkins Hospital."
"What?"
"Somebody shot you."
She reached out to touch his hand. The softness of her hand ignited something in his drug-suppressed consciousness. For a minute or so, Kelly couldn't figure out what it was. Like a cloud of smoke, it shifted and revolved, forming a picture before his eyes. The missing pieces began to come together, and even though he understood it was horror that awaited him, his mind struggled to hurry them along. In the end, it was the nurse who did it for him. Sandy O'Toole had left her mask on for a reason. An attractive woman, like many nurses, she felt that male patients responded well to the idea of someone like her taking a personal interest in them. Now that patient Kelly, John, was more or less alert, she reached up and untied the mask to give him her beaming feminine smile, the first good thing of the day for him. Men liked Sandra O'Toole. from her tall, athletic frame to the gap between her front teeth. She had no idea why they considered the gap sexy. Food got caught there, after all. But as long as it worked, it was one more tool for her business of helping to make sick people well. And so she smiled at him, just for business. The result was like no other she had encountered. Her patient went ghostly pale, not the white of snow or fresh linen, but the mottled, sickly look and texture of styrofoam. Her first thought was that something had gone gravely wrong, a massive internal bleed, perhaps, or even a clot-driven thrombosis. He might have screamed, but couldn't catch his breath, and his hands fell limp. His eyes never left her, and after a moment O'Toole realized that she had somehow caused whatever it was. O'Toole's first instinct was to take his hand and say that everything was all right, but she knew instantly that it wasn't true.
"Oh, God! Oh, God! Pam!"
The look on what ought to have been a ruggedly handsome face was one of black despair. "She was with me," Kelly told Rosen a few minutes later. "Do you know anything, Doc?" "The police will be here in a few minutes, John, but no, I don't know anything. Maybe they took her to another hospital." He tried to hope. But Sam knew that it was a lie, and he hated himself for lying. He made a show of taking Kelly's vital signs, something Sandy could have done just as well, before examining his patient's back. "You're going to be okay. How's the shoulder?" "Not real great, Sam," Kelly replied, still groggy. "How bad?" "Shotgun. You took quite a bit, but..." "Was the window on the car rolled up?" "Yeah," Kelly said, remembering the rain. "That's one of the things that saved you. The shoulder muscles are pretty beaten up, and you damn near bled to death, but there won't be any permanent damage except for some scarring. I did the job myself." Kelly looked up. "Thanks, Sam. Pain isn't so bad. Worse the last time I..." "Quiet down, John," Rosen ordered gently, giving the neck a close look. He made a mental note to order a complete new set of X-rays just to make sure there wasn't something he had missed, maybe close to the spine. "The pain medication will kick in pretty fast. Save the heroics. We don't award points for that here, okay?" "Aye, aye." "Please check the other hospitals for Pam, okay?" Kelly asked, hope yet in his voice, though he knew better, too. Two uniformed officers had been waiting the whole time for Kelly to come out from under. Rosen brought in the older of the two a few minutes later. The questioning was brief, on doctor's orders. After confirming his identity, they asked about Pam. They already had a physical description from Rosen, but not a surname, which Kelly had to provide. The officers made note of his appointment with Lieutenant Allen and left after a few minutes as the victim started to fade out. The shock of the shooting and surgery, added to the pain medications, would diminish the value of what he said anyway, Rosen pointed out. "So who's the girl?" the senior officer asked. "I didn't even know her last name until a couple minutes ago," Rosen said, seated in his office. He was dopey from lack of sleep, and his commentary suffered as well. "She was addicted to barbiturates when we met them. She and Kelly were living together, I suppose. We helped her clean up."
"Who's we?"
"My wife, Sarah. She's a pharmacologist here. You can talk to her if you want."
"We will," the officer assured him.
"What about Mr. Kelly?"
"Ex-Navy, Vietnam vet."
"Do you have any reason to believe that he's a drug user, sir?"
"Not a chance," Rosen answered, a slight edge on his voice.
"His physical condition is too good for that, and I saw his reaction when we found out that Pam was using pills. I had to calm him down. Definitely not an addict. I'm a physician, I would have noticed." The policeman was not overly impressed, but accepted it at face value. The detectives would have a lot of fun with this one, he thought. What had appeared to be a simple robbery was now at least a kidnapping as well. Wonderful news.
"So what was he doing in that part of town?"
"I don't know," Sam admitted. "Who's this Lieutenant Allen?"
"Homicide, Western District," the cop explained. I wonder why they had an appointment. That's something we'll get from the lieutenant, sir. Was this a robbery? Probably. It sure looks that way. We found his wallet a block away. No cash, no credit cards, just his driver's license. He also had a handgun in his car. Whoever robbed him must have missed that. That's against the law, by the way, the cop noted. Another officer came in. I checked the name again. I knew I heard it before. He did a job for Allen. Remember last year, the Gooding case? The senior man looked up from his notes. Oh, yeah, he's the guy who found the gun? Right, and he ended up training our divers. It still doesn't explain what the hell he was doing over there, the cop pointed out. True, his partner admitted, but it makes it hard to believe he's a player. The senior officer shook his head. There was a girl with him. She's missing. Kidnapping, too? What do we have on her? Just a name. Pamela Madden. 20. Recovering doper. Missing. We have Mr. Kelly, his car, his gun, and that's it. No shells from the shotgun. No witnesses at all. A missing girl, probably, but a description that could fit 10,000 local girls. Robbery, kidnapping. All in all, not that atypical a case. They often started off knowing damned little. In any case, the two uniformed officers had mainly determined that the detectives would take this one over almost immediately. She wasn't from around here. She had an accent. Texas, somewhere out there. What else? The senior officer asked. Come on, Doc, anything you know, okay? Sam grimaced. She had been the victim of sexual abuse. She might have been a hooker. My wife said, hell, I saw it, evidence of scars on her back. She'd been whipped, some permanent scarring from welts, that sort of thing. We didn't press, but she might have been a prostitute. Mr. Kelly has strange habits and acquaintances, doesn't he? The officer observed while making notes. From what you just said, he helps cops too, doesn't he? Professor Rosen was getting angry. Anything else? I have rounds to make. Doctor, what we have here is a definite attempted murder, probably as part of a robbery, and maybe a kidnapping also. Those are serious crimes. I have procedures to follow, just like you do. When will Kelly be up for a real interview? Tomorrow, probably, but he's going to be very rocky for a couple of days. Is 10 in the morning okay, sir? Yes. The cops rose. Somebody will be back then, sir. Rosen watched them leave. This, strangely enough, had been his first real experience with a major criminal investigation. His work more often dealt with traffic and industrial accidents. He found himself unable to believe that Kelly could be a criminal. Yet that had seemed to be the thrust of their questions, wasn't it? That's when Dr. Pretlow came in. We finished the blood work on Kelly. She handed the data over. Gonorrhea. He should be more careful. I recommend penicillin. Any known allergies? No. Rosen closed his eyes and swore. What the hell else would happen today? Not that big a deal, sir. It looks like a very early case. When he's feeling better, I'll have social services talk to him about... No, you won't, Rosen said in a low growl. But the girl he got it from is probably dead, and we will not force him to remember her that way. It was the first time Sam had admitted the probable facts to himself, and that made it all the worse, declaring her dead. He had little to base it on, but his instincts told him it must be so. Doctor, the law requires... It was just too much. Rosen was on the point of exploding. That's a good man in there. I watched him fall in love with a girl who's probably been murdered, and his last memory of her will not be that she gave him venereal disease. Is that clear, Doctor? As far as the patient is concerned, the medication is for a post-op infection. Mark the chart accordingly. No, Doctor, I will not do that. Professor Rosen made the proper notations. Done. He looked up. Dr. Pretlow, you have the makings of an excellent technical surgeon. Try to remember that the patients upon whom we perform our procedures are human beings with feelings, will you? If you do so, I think you will find that the job is somewhat easier in the long run. It will also make you a much better physician.
And what was he so worked up about? Pretlow asked herself on the way out.
Chapter 8 Concealment. It was a combination of things. June 20th was a hot day and a dull one. A photographer for the Baltimore Sun had a new camera, a Nikon to replace his venerable Honeywell Pentax. And while he mourned for his old one, the new camera, like a new love, had all sorts of new features to explore and enjoy. One of them was a whole collection of telephoto lenses that the distributor had thrown in. The Nikon was a new model, and the company had wanted it accepted within the news photo community quickly. And so 20 photographers at various newspapers around the country had gotten free sets. Bob Price had gotten his because of a Pulitzer Prize earned 3 years before. He was sitting in his car on Druid Lake Drive now, listening to his police radio, hoping for something interesting to happen, but nothing was. And so he was playing with his new camera, practicing his lens-switching skills. The Nikon was beautifully machined, and as an infantryman will learn to strip and clean his rifle in total darkness, Price was changing from one lens to another by feel, forcing himself to scan the area just as a means of keeping his eyes off a procedure that had to become as natural and automatic as zipping his pants. It was the crows that caught his attention. Located off-center in the irregularly shaped lake was a fountain. No example of architectural prowess. It was a plain concrete cylinder sticking 6 or 8 feet up from the water's surface. And in it were a few jets that shot water more or less straight up, though today shifting winds were scattering the water haphazardly in all directions. Crows were circling the water, trying occasionally to get in, but defeated by the swirling sheets of clear white spray, which appeared to frighten them. What were the crows interested in? His hand searched the camera case for the 200-millimeter lens, which he attached to the camera body, bringing it up to his eyes smoothly. Sweet Jesus! Price instantly shot 10 rapid frames. Only then did he get on his car radio, telling his base office to notify the police at once. He switched lenses again, this time selecting a 300-millimeter, his longest. After finishing one roll, he threaded another, this one 100-speed color. He steadied the camera on the windowsill of the tired old Chevy and fired off another roll. One crow, he saw, got through the water, settling on... Oh, God, no. Because it was, after all, a human body there, a young woman, white as alabaster. And in the through-the-lens optics, he could see the crow right there, its clawed feet strutting around the body, its pitiless black eyes surveying what to the bird was nothing more than a large and diverse meal. Price sat his camera down and shifted his car into gear. He violated 2 separate traffic laws, getting as close to the fountain as he could, and in what was for him a rare case of humanity overcoming professionalism, slammed his hand down on the horn, hoping to startle the bird away. The bird looked up, but saw that whatever the noise came from, there was no immediate threat here, and it went back to selecting the first morsel for its iron-hard beak. It was then that Price made a random but effective guess. He blinked his lights on and off, and to the bird that was unusual enough that it thought better of things and flew away. It might have been an owl, after all, and the meal wasn't going anywhere. The bird would just wait for the threat to go away before returning to eat. "What gives?" a cop asked, pulling alongside. "There's a body on the fountain. Look." He handed the camera over. "God," the policeman breathed, handing it back after a long, quiet moment. He made the radio call while Price shot another roll. Police cars arrived, rather like the crows, one at a time, until 8 were parked within sight of the fountain. A fire truck arrived in 10 minutes, along with someone from the Department of Recreation and Parks, trailering a boat behind his pickup. This was quickly put into the water. Then came the forensics people with a lab truck, and it was time to go out to the fountain. Price asked to go along. He was a better photographer than the one the cops used, but was rebuffed, and so he continued to record the event from the lake's edge. There wouldn't be another Pulitzer in this. There could have been, he thought, but the price of that would have involved immortalizing the instinctive act of a carrion bird,
defiling the body of a girl in the midst of a major city. And that wasn't worth the nightmares. He had enough of those already. A crowd had already gathered. The police officers congregated in small knots, trading quiet comments and barbed attempts at grim humor. A TV news truck arrived from its studio on Television Hill just north of the park, which held the city zoo. It was a place Bob Price often took his young children, and they especially liked the lion, not so originally named Leo, and the polar bears, and all the other predators that were safely confined behind steel bars and stone walls. Unlike some people, he thought, watching them lift the body and place it in a rubber bag. At least her torment was over. Price changed roles one more time to record the process of loading the body into the coroner's station wagon. A Sun reporter was here now. He'd ask the questions while Price determined how good his new camera really was back at his darkroom on Calvert Street.
"John, they found her," Rosen said. "Dead?" Kelly couldn't look up. The tone of Sam's voice had already told him the real news. It wasn't a surprise, but the end of hope never comes easily to anyone. Sam nodded. "Yeah." "How?" "I don't know yet. The police called me a few minutes ago, and I came over as quick as I could."
"Thanks, pal."
If a human voice could sound dead, Sam told himself, Kelly's did.
"I'm sorry, John. You know how I felt about her."
"Yes, sir, I do. It's not your fault, Sam."
"You're not eating."
Rosen gestured to the food tray.
"I'm not real hungry."
"If you want to recover, you have to get your strength back."
"Why?" Kelly asked, staring at the floor.
Rosen came over and grasped Kelly's right hand. There wasn't much to say. The surgeon didn't have the stomach to look at Kelly's face. He'd pieced enough together to know that his friend was blaming himself, and he didn't know enough to talk to him about it, at least not yet. Death was a companion for Sam Rosen, M.D., FACS. Neurosurgeons dealt with major injuries to that most delicate part of the human anatomy, and the injuries to which they most often responded were frequently beyond anyone's power to repair. But the unexpected death of a person one knows can be too much for anyone.
"Is there anything I can do?" he asked after a minute or two.
"Not right now, Sam. Thanks."
"Maybe a priest?"
"No, not now."
"It wasn't your fault, John."
"Whose, then?"
"She trusted me, Sam. I blew it."
"The police want to talk to you some more."
"I told them tomorrow morning."
He'd been through his second interview in the morning. Kelly had already told them much of what he knew. Her full name, her hometown, how they'd met. Yes, they had been intimate. Yes, she had been a prostitute, a runaway. Yes, her body had shown signs of abuse. But not everything. Somehow he'd been unable to volunteer information because to have done so would have entailed admitting to other men the dimensions of his failure. And so he had avoided some of their inquiries, claiming pain, which was quite real, but not real enough. He already sensed that the police didn't like him, but that was okay. He didn't much like himself at the moment.
"Okay. I should do some things with your medications. I've tried to go easy. I don't like overdoing the things, but they'll help you relax, John."
"Dope me up more?" Kelly's head lifted, and the expression was not something that Rosen ever wanted to see again.
"You think that's really going to make a difference, Sam?"
Rosen looked away, unable to meet his eyes now that it was possible to do so. "You're ready for a regular bed. I'll have you moved into one in a few minutes."
"Okay."
The surgeon wanted to say more, but couldn't find the right words. He left without any others. It took Sandy O'Toole and two orderlies to move him, as carefully as they could, onto a standard hospital bed. She cranked up the head portion to relieve the pressure on his injured shoulder.
"I heard," she told him.
It bothered her that his grief wasn't right. He was a tough man, but not a fool.
Perhaps he was one of those men who did his weeping alone, but she was sure he hadn't done it yet. And that was necessary, she knew. Tears released poisons from inside.